It's wonderful to be here and to see you all. Let's turn the attention within, focusing at the point between the eyebrows, the ajna. There we see the light, the divine light. Initially, when we shut our eyes, we see nothing but darkness. But gradually, as we attune ourselves to this sacred spot, as what Jesus called the doorway to the kingdom of heaven, it begins to open up, and we see there, at first, various types of light, and then it begins to refine itself. And we see, as if in a beautiful circle, a golden light, yellow golden light. And within that golden light, we might then see a deep, deep blue light. Now the gold light is the emanation of all creation on every single level. And it is the purity of creation. We are told in Genesis that when God created, he looked at his handiwork and he said, "It is good. It is good." In the Vedas of the India, we are told that all creation is a blissful expression of God, ananda, a blissful expression. But then the human mind began to dwell on the things of the senses, and it lost its connection with the divine consciousness from which it had emanated. Unbelievably so, it seems. And then it dwells at it for a time in a feeling of separation. Now, everything comes from divine consciousness. Of that, there is no doubt. Everything returns to it. And therefore, there is nothing but divine consciousness, within, without, and everywhere about. So it is only a trick of the mind that makes us feel separate, that makes us not realize who and what we are in divine consciousness. Once we understand that, then our primary duty becomes the act of rediscovering, reconnecting with that divine consciousness. And this is the journey of the Son of Man, as Jesus refers to it. He gives himself two designations. One is the Son of Man, and the other is the Son of God. The Son of Man is that which is born of the material world and the material body. It is the offspring of two parents. And then there is the Son of God, that which was before all creation came into being, but part of the Savior consciousness, or that which redeems wayward consciousness, is the Son of God, because embedded in every aspect of creation is the perfection of the divine. This is Christ consciousness. So you see, everything comes together, whether it be of the Christian scriptures or the scriptures of the East, they're all blueprints, descriptions of what it is that has gone into making up this universe. If we find ourselves in a state of separation, how to find our way back, and then the description of what it is like as we make our way back and all the experiences that we go through, and they are many. Not because there is any sense of absolute separation. That cannot be. You could not breathe a breath, have a thought, be able to move a muscle if divine consciousness were not constantly supplying you. But because we dwell in this sense of separation, then we no longer feel that we have this oneness. We no longer are aware that divine consciousness is streaming through our minds. that in fact every aspect of life is all a fulfillment and a flow of divine. So knowing this, we put our minds upon God alone, because God is that creative, blissful, everlasting force and intelligence that has gone into creating everything that is, and yet is untouched by the ignorance or feeling of separation that individuals go through. One of the building blocks upon which we dedicate our spiritual life and also that gives us progress is that of faith. And I wrote out a posting this morning that I thought I would read to you from. And it's entitled, Removing Mountains of Worry. Jesus said unto them, Because of your unbelief, verily I say unto you, if you have the faith of a grain of mustard seed, and a mustard seed's a very tiny little thing, you shall say unto this mountain, Remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Faith is such an interesting word, especially as it pertains to our spiritual understanding. The dictionary tells us faith is complete trust or confidence in someone or something. Jesus often relates faith to spontaneous healing of a remarkable nature. Faith in God, faith in yourself, faith in the goodness of life, so many elements to such a deep word. You start by mastering the ABCs of spiritual living, and faith is basic foundation block. Your basic attitude about life tells a lot about your real inner life. Faith in God means you shift the burden onto Him. God is the operator, you are the machine. Your part is to sensitively attune yourself to the operator of the machine. Be an extension of His will, intelligence, and power. Acting in perfect concert with divine consciousness, you are free of fear and doubt. Perfect faith means absolute comprehension that God is in control. I have had numerous medical tests and procedures, and it surprises me how much fear is exhibited by patients. You can understand concern and a natural desire to have to be that you have to be there, but health hits very close to home, to our attachment to this body. Imagination can run rampant and add worry upon worry. There are, of course, other challenges to faith. Money problems can be a great strain, not having enough, being in debt, feeling the pressure that if you should have more, and that you should have more, and it reflects on who you are if you do not. Faith in God is knowing who you are independent of outer circumstances. Faith is knowing that God is your supply, and through active attunement with Him, He will lead you towards prosperity that is exactly right for you. Another area is in relationships. Having that perfect someone in your life, children who behave correctly, problems with parents, friends, workmates. Faith in God means He is your primary relationship in life. Through your attunement to Him, you feel His love, companionship. You are a friend to others, and in time draw good associates to you. And He is your protection in difficult relationships. Faith runs through every part of your life. And each day you can assess your progress in the development of perfect faith. With faith you have peace, inner assurance, and a true knowing that God is guiding you and protecting you. It is a true basis for your spiritual life. And this is absolutely true. We must be able to analyze ourselves. We must be able to take a look at ourselves. Without our ability to be able to observe ourselves, we will not grow spiritually. If we are constantly finding blame or feeling shame about things, because shame has the tendency to want to hide from things, being able to assess yourselves means you are able to honestly look at your behavior, see how it is affecting this world, see how effective you are in this world, and learn from your experience. If we are constantly repeating the same mistakes and not learning from our experience, that's a problem. It's a very big problem for us, and it also affects those who are around us. So we cannot just blithely go along in this life and expect everything to be taken care of by some divine force, or that life will just simply work itself out. We must be putting our shoulder to the wheel. We must be making every effort on our own part so that we can really go to work on life. Look at your life. Are you free of worry? This is one of the great things about spiritual realization. As you gain this trust, this faith, this perfect knowing that God is in control, then you take off the burden, the great burden that most people carry upon their shoulders. It can feel like 1,000 pounds weighing in on us, and it is a tremendously difficult thing. It saps our life energy. It consumes our mind. It interferes with your sleep. Everything. You sit down to meditate, and the first thing you know, your mind is beginning to revolve around those things that you worry about. And you're not meditating at all. You're just simply spending your time worrying. And so in order to change this, we must really go to work on ourselves. Go to the roots of where that fear is. Now, we have lived many, many lifetimes, and this has been a very difficult period of time. In the last few thousand years, Mother Hamilton said that not only is it the Kali Yuga, that is the age of darkness in the smaller 24,000-year cycle, but it's also the depths of the Kali Yuga in the much larger cycle that goes by millions of years, or at least hundreds of thousands. And so this has been a very dark period that we've come through, and we see that, where learning and writing and all sorts of organization just simply went by the wayside, and it was whoever was the strongest man in the room got to rule everything. We've come out of that, thankfully, to a large degree, but we're still struggling with it. We're still struggling with the age of darkness, and it has its hold on many, many people. And it has its hold on us, not because we are ill-intentioned, but because there are so many things that have happened to us. There's been starvation, there's been wars, there's been deprivation of all sorts. And as a result of that, it's left an imprint on our mind. And so we think in terms of poverty, we think in terms of lack. We are afraid of different things. Sometimes people are unaccountably afraid of walking next to a cliff, or a spider, or a snake. Now, it is true, there are certain things that we should avoid. We shouldn't be too blithe about going next to a cliff. We shouldn't just approach any old snake, or any old spider, for that matter. My grandmother one time was bit by a black widow, and it caused an infection in her and almost killed her at the time. When she was a young girl, they didn't have any treatment for it. And so these things are dangerous to the body, and we must protect the body. But it is a much different thing to have a concern than it is to have a fear. Fear is something that takes on a life of its own. And suddenly we're walking through the woods at night, and every bush turns into a bear, every stick on the ground turns into a poisonous snake, and we can just start running wild as a result. And because of that, we can fall into a ditch or fall off of a cliff and really harm ourselves, when in reality, there wasn't anything other than our imagination running us. And so we have to be knowing what the difference is between a concern. A concern is, I know I have something come up. I have to keep track of the date and the time if it's an appointment. I have to make plans if it's something that is coming up that I need to prepare for. And so that's all in the area of concern. We're thinking about it. We're planning for it. We're doing the best that we can in order to prepare ourselves for a situation. But a worry is something that just goes around and around on the merry-go-round of the mind. And it takes us nowhere. It expends our energy. And we take that mind and we say, listen, we take it in hand and we go to work on ourselves and we say, this is enough of this. I am here to have self-mastery, to have mastery over my life energy, over my thoughts. Most of us with the mind is like having a pet, a dog, for instance, and never bothering to train it. And the entire life is spent catering to the whims of whatever it is that the dog wants. And so we just cater to the mind. If it wants this, if it doesn't want that, that's what dictates what we go through. And it's run by many of these past associations that creates fear in us or creates desire nature. So self-mastery is knowing who you are beyond the mind. Now, some people will say you are the mind. If you didn't have these different synapse connections in your brain, then you would be nothing, nothing at all, because you are a product of the brain. But they haven't gone deeply enough into the science of mind, because before mind, before brain, there is consciousness. I know this for an absolute fact because God has given me experiences that have gone before this body was born. Sometimes experiences that are outside of this body or this material realm. And so into the astral and into the causal realms it is. Pure spiritual consciousness that's before all three levels of creation. The mind or causal, the electrical or astral, and the physical realm. Other times I've been aware of existing in other physical forms. And at one time that I left a physical form and that I rose up above that physical form and now I was in my astral form. And so all of these things are realities. So consciousness predates the mind. Now, if somebody has physical problems, if they have a stroke, for instance, and part of their brain dies and they no longer have access to that, well, it's like a machine that suddenly has part of its functions destroyed, and it's not able to do everything that it was intended to do from the beginning. Now, some people are born with such dysfunctions in the mind, and it's a terrible thing when it happens, but it's a product of what that child, as a soul, has done in previous lifetimes. It's very difficult to look at a child and see the lovely innocence and the beauty of this small child and connect it with any past life experiences that it may have had, but it's true. And so all of these things come to be. I worked with mentally ill for many years as a counselor, and God showed me in many cases where those experiences came from and why they were suffering in the way that they were. In Dante's Inferno and Hell, and most versions of Hell, there are many repetitious experiences. You go back to the Greek versions of Hell or the Roman versions as well. And it's a repetition of experience over and over and over again and never getting anywhere. And mentally ill definitely have that. They have recurrent themes that go on, but it's a world unto themselves. It's not a world that anyone else can share. And so they have these thoughts. Sometimes they're paranoid. Sometimes they have psychosis. And they all come from someplace. So you have to understand that this life is ultimately fair, but it's a very tough place, a very tough place. And this is the toughest of all creation, what goes on here. We have more freedom of will in one sense, because we can go to such extents in darkness here. Now, we can also in the astral and in the causal. But here we get lost to such a degree. And we have to come back into a physical body in order to work it out. And what does it mean to work it out? One is we have to pay for those things that we have done in the past in a negative way. We also get the benefits of everything we've done in a positive way. So there are times when there are children prodigy, those who can play the piano from a very early age, 2, 3 years old, they can sit down and they can play like a master. And it's really a marvelous thing. Where does that intelligence come from? Where does that ability come from? It's because they've earned it. And so every strength that you have and that you were born into this world with, you have because you have earned it. Now, you are selected into a particular body with particular genetic patterns, and you even turn on and switch off genetic patterns as your consciousness joins the fetus, the zygote, and then the fetus, and as it develops, and it goes along. So you see, there are many more choices than is oftentimes thought of, as these genetic codes are turned on and turned off to match the consciousness of the individual soul who's coming into that body. And it's tailor-made for them. So while we can certainly have compassion, and we do, for any soul who comes into a body that doesn't function fully, still we can also understand that it's exactly designed for that individual. And as a result of that, they will fulfill what they need to in this lifetime. Now, not everybody will be able to aspire for perfect realization. It's not that it's not available. It's just simply that that individual, in all likelihood, will be so consumed with working out their karma, it'll never dawn on them that there's anything higher. If you come into this world with some knowledge, some awareness, some knowing deep inside of you, that there is something higher, that you were born for something more than just groveling on this earth and going through the things that you have to, then you are also the product of your past. You have made spiritual progress in past lifetimes, and that is awakening inside of you. You may go through a period of time where you don't have any awareness of that, and then suddenly you have this spiritual yearning come to you. Ramana Maharshi was such a great example of this. He was a 16-year-old boy, and he was just leading an ordinary life. He didn't have any particular thoughts of anything higher, anything greater. But he lost his parents, and that certainly grieved him. But there are many children who lose their parents along the way from an early age. But for him, suddenly he had this tremendous fear of death. So he came home from school, and he thought, well, what is this death? And he laid himself down onto the floor, and he said, all right, I'm dead. Nothing going on, nothing moving. I'm totally still. And as a result of this, because he was such a tremendous soul when he came into this earth, he had instant realization. He realized the I am that is beyond the body, the I am that is beyond thought, the perfect self with a capital S. And he realized that, and it changed his life completely. And he left his home, and he went to a temple area in the town of Tiruvannamalai. And he went to the temple there, and he started meditating. And as is likely to happen anywhere in the world, young boys discovered him sitting there. So they thought they would have some fun by their own standards, and started throwing little dirt clods and little rocks and trying to disturb him. Well, he wasn't easily disturbed, but he didn't care for all of this attention. So he went down under the basement of this large temple, and had been to that temple, and it's a lovely, incredibly large temple, and he meditated there. And he so lost body consciousness that bugs were eating into his legs, and he wasn't even aware of it. And for the rest of his life, he had scarring on his legs from where these bugs and little critters were chewing into him. But he was beyond all of that, because he was in the bliss of God. He had realized himself, and so what he advocated was that people ask themselves, who am I? Who am I It's a path of a jnani. A jnani is wisdom, discriminative wisdom. And this question you take deeply. And first you ask it, who am I? And it may take you right into the center of your heart center, right in the center of your chest. And there you say, well, I am here. And you continue to ask the question until you go all the way and realize who you are. And at that point, you realize I am not this body. I am not this name that I go by. I am not this profession. I am not this family. I am not this community. I am not this nation. I am not any of it. I am beyond all of that. I have always existed and always will exist. You just know that when you enter into that supreme state of consciousness. And then gradually his mind came back down into this body consciousness. And he just sat there, but he had such tremendous magnetism to him. People were drawn to him. And then they began to ask him questions. And he might say to someone asking a question, who is asking the question? You see how it goes? And then you have to analyze that. You have to think about that. Contemplate on it. Who is it who's asking this question? Who is it who has this mind that is always at work, always having commentary on everything that is? I also wanted to read from you from the original Gospel of Ramakrishna. It's one that was written by Master Mahasya before Nikalananda had done the editing on it. And so it reads somewhat differently. This is entitled, The Fickleness of Mind. Bhagavan, it is natural with the mind of one who lives in the world. Sometimes it is on a high plane and sometimes on a low. Sometimes there is a great upheaval of devotional feeling. Then again it subsides because the attraction of lust and wealth is very strong. A devotee who lives in the world may meditate on God and repeat his holy name, but again his mind is attracted to the power of lust and wealth. Just as a fly sometimes lights on the most delicious sweetmeat and sometimes relishes the taste of filth or of a rotten carcass. That's quite a description for the mind, isn't it? But it's true. It is different, however, with those who have renounced the world. They have detached their mind entirely from lust and wealth and have fixed it upon the Supreme. They constantly drink the nectar of divine love. The mind of a true sannyasi does not care for anything other than the Supreme. He leaves the place where worldly talk prevails. He listens to discourses about the highest spiritual truth alone. A true sannyasi does not speak of worldly matters. He utters no word which is not bearing upon the spiritual ideal. A bee sits on flowers only to drink honey. He does not care for any other object. Thus referring to Rakhal, Swami Brahmanananda, who had a wife and a child before he renounced the world, Ramakrishna said, Rakhal and others like him now understood which is good and which is evil, which is real and which is unreal. They have realized that earthly relations are transitory and ephemeral. They will never again be attached to the world. They are like eels which live in the mud but remain untouched by it. Ramakrishna himself was married, and he advocated for many. He says, fight the battle from the castle. In other words, stay in your family home. Stay in this world. But do your sadhana there. Sadhana is your spiritual practice. Chant the name of God. It is such a simple thing to be able to do. And as you do it, as Swami Ramdas advocated, Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And Mother sang it, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om. And she would sing this, and I would just, when I first heard it, I found it to be a haunting melody, but I couldn't forget it. And I began to chant it, and as I chanted it, I began to feel this peace. I began to feel upliftment. I felt the vibration in it. You see, when you chant, you don't just chant with your words, but you feel the vibration in your body. You feel and think about the attributes of God. O Lord, you are all powerful. You are all bliss. You are all purity. You are all joy. You are all light and upliftment. And by repeating these virtues and singing the name of God, you purify the mind. And gradually you begin to ascend up through the spinal stairway. Now most people live in the three lower centers of consciousness in the spine. It starts at the base of the skull and works, or the spine, excuse me, the base of the spine and works its way up. And so at the very base is the intensity and desire for life. It is where we go when we feel threatened and that we always are desiring to have more life. And it's the root of our attachment to this body because we identify life with this body in a human sense. Then the next chakra up, or this wheel of life force that's there that represents the consciousness of pleasure. It is of desire. It is where it is sexually rooted in our spine. Now, sex oftentimes is talked about as the polar opposite of God consciousness. And that is because it roots us to this body. It's not that there's anything inherently bad. It was created by God. And yet, when we become so filled with sex consciousness, as some people are, then there's not anything else, you see. That becomes the root of everything. And it polarizes you against divine consciousness, because divine consciousness is free of all of that. It is above all these lower elements and forces. As Ramana Maharshi sat in underneath this temple, and he was completely cut off from all that we consider human. You say, well, why would somebody do that? Somebody as intelligent, somebody as insensitive as Ramana Maharshi obviously was and came to be. Why would he cut himself off from everything? And that is because most people live life through the senses. And living it through the senses is living it vicariously in a way. Because you're not directly connected to the source of life. You're living it through what comes in through the senses and how the senses are stimulated. And so you're living life indirectly. But to get directly connected to the source of life is to tune into the spine and into the higher centers in the spine and in the brain. And that gets you this direct connection. And it is powerful. And it is transforming. And because it is so powerful and so transforming, many people shy away from it because they don't know who they will become, who they will be once this transformative force takes over. As I sat in meditation so many years ago, and this tremendous Kundalini force erupted inside of me, and it was a powerful thing that absolutely shot from the base of my spine all the way up my spine, and then through the brain, and right here to the ajna, this third eye point. And it got so hot there, unbelievably hot, and my whole attention was rooted to the ajna. I couldn't think of anything else but that, because it was such a terrific force that was there. And it was wonderful, in a sense, and it was also very powerful. But I felt absolute faith that this was right. I had been with Mother for some little time before that. So I was aware of her teachings and that this was something that was natural and necessary. in order to make spiritual progress, so I was thrilled about it. But I was also out of control with it in the sense that I didn't make this happen. True, I was sitting there, I was meditating, but I had no idea that this would happen before it did. I felt this tremendous force at the base of my spine, and then it was like a snap. And then suddenly it was coursing up with this incredible power. And from that standpoint, and from that point on, I was not in control of it. It was in control of me. Now, perhaps if I had tried hard enough, I could have stopped it. I could have separated myself, not right in that moment, but as time went on. Because it is a purifying force, but purification doesn't happen just in a moment. It happens over time. So there are thousands and millions of decisions that we make on a daily basis that either direct our mind upward or downward. So to be a true sannyasi, and I've met many sannyasis, those who wear the ochre robes of renunciation, but they have not renounced this world. They live very much in it. And I've asked many of them about these kundalini experiences, and they haven't had them. So it was surprising to me, because this orange robe represents that flame of consciousness, you see. It is this kundalini force that it represents in the purification. One time I was getting off of a ferry up in Canada, and we're driving by this field of pumpkins. It's this time of year, and it was wonderful to see these hundreds and hundreds of pumpkins out there. But what happened in my mind, I thought, all of those pumpkins, they look like flames. And then suddenly I realized that these orange ochre robes represent the flame of renunciation, the flame of kundalini rising, and the purification that happens with that. And so that's what it's supposed to represent. But just putting on some cloth doesn't make it so. Nor does not wearing the cloth mean that you don't have it. One time, a disciple of Lari Mahasaya's was coming in and bowing at the feet of the master. And Lari Mahasaya told Swami Pranabananda, go out into the courtyard if you want to meet Babaji. He's coming. You've always had a desire to meet him. So here is your chance. So he went out to the courtyard in great anticipation. And in through the door came a young Indian man, simply dressed in a white dhoti, a white cloth, and didn't look particularly extraordinary to him at all. But he thought, my master said, this is Babaji, this must be so. And so he dropped down to the ground and pronounced to him. But Babaji knew his thoughts, and he says, you're surprised to see me like this. And he said, well, sir, I am. And he said, you tell me, you wear this orange cloth. Everybody wants something from you. They come to you, they want you to pray for them, they want you to do this or that for them. I wear these clothes, nobody wants anything from me. And I don't need anything from anyone. So you tell me which is better. You see, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, lost in the common life, a yogi yakt, that is, one who is completely free. Now, not lost in the sense of not knowing who they are, but that they wander through life appearing as anyone else. Krishna himself, he took on a human form. He lived as a king. Now, many people wouldn't be expecting a king. There is a story of a young disciple who was sent by his teacher. And he said, this man is your king. And so he went to King, his name is slipping my mind right now, but Janaka, King Janaka. And he saw him in the court, and he had all of these people coming to him, and he was making worldly decisions, and he was surrounded by all these courtiers. And the young boy thought, well, this man can't be spiritually realized. Look at, he's just being a king and an ordinary man. So he started to leave, but the king, being a realized man, knew his thoughts. And he said, young man, come here. And so he came, and he said, why did you come? He said, I was sent by my teacher, telling me you are my guru, but I don't believe it. And he said, well, let us sit down and talk for a little bit before you go. So the boy had some few books that were very sacred to him that he had tied up, and he set them down onto the ground nearby. And he sat, and they started talking about God and about philosophy. And suddenly there was the smell of smoke. And the smoke got more and more, and suddenly some of the men came in and told the king, there's a fire that's consuming the palace. You must come and help direct the efforts to put it out. The king said, no. He says, I'm here with my young friend here. We're talking about God. How could we leave this to do something like that? You take care of it. You know best. So the fellows went away, and the flames entered right into the room where they were sitting. And the smoke was very thick, but the king kept on talking about God. He was obviously in an uplifted, his face shone with light. He's in such a blissful state. And suddenly the flames came so close that they were starting to lap at the books that this boy had brought that were sacred to him. And so he reached over and he started pulling the books a little bit closer to himself, trying to protect them from the flames. The king noticed this. And he says, what are you doing? He says, we're talking about God. My entire palace is burning down. But you are worried about these few books here? You tell me who is attached and who is unattached. And the boy realized his error, that this individual who is sitting in front of him, who is seemingly a king and carrying on all of these duties, was a greatly realized being as he was. And then suddenly the mind of the king, it blew out and it suppressed all the flames that had been going. And everything was all right. So you see, we're tested as we come along. What little types of attachment. God has taken me through many, many experiences. And when he is taking me through the mystical crucifixion, he took away home, he took away family even. He took away everything. He took away profession, everything that I had defined myself. Now, before that, I would have told you I was fairly detached from all these things. But I realized that each one of these things, home and family and profession, they inform me to some degree of who I was. Therefore, there was attachment to them. Because I'm not defined by any of those things. Whether I have those things or don't have those things, whether they come or they go, how many lives, how many bodies have we had? How many homes have we had? How many families have we had? Sri Yukteswar said that when most souls leave this body, they go into the astral worlds, which is a much more refined place than here on earth. And there they meet different individuals from different lifetimes. So how many husbands, how many wives, how many children, how many mothers, how many fathers have we had down through time? And he said, the individual is a little bit confused as to who to love the most because they had had special relationships with each one of them in different lifetimes. And so it is that we have all of these different relationships. The thing to do is to universalize your vision. Now, in the beginning, we close our eyes to meditate and to go up above all the things of this world. And that's necessary. That is the state of the bhakta, that who is yearning and desiring for realization alone. And then we come into a state where we are freed of everything that is. That's the state of jnana. We realize that spirit is true, spirit is real, and this world feels like a dream, not quite real. And I had that experience through many years where this world just didn't seem very real at all. And then you go beyond that state, and you realize that this whole universe is an expression of that formless, beginningless, endless spirit, and that it too is pure divine consciousness. So it no longer seems like a dream. It seems like it is God. The world is God, Swami Ram Dass wrote. The world is God. It is that divine expression. And you see the things of this world. You see the floor that we're on, the walls around us, the ceiling above us, the air that we breathe. Everything is saturated with divine consciousness. There is no place that you can look that you do not see divinity being manifest. And you are in an ocean of bliss. And as Mother said from her fully realized state, that she could operate on any level that anyone else could, but it didn't separate her from divine consciousness. You see how wonderful that is. So it is not this human body per se, or living in this material world, that prohibits us from knowing God. It is the preoccupation that our mind has taken up with it, that the world is all in all for us. This is the fallacy. This is the lie. And so this is the thing we must root out in ourselves. First of all, finding the supreme reality, God consciousness. And then, as we get established in that God consciousness, realizing this whole universe and this astral and this causal realms are all expressions of divine consciousness, and that there is nowhere that we can go, nothing that we can do that is separate from that. Now, Mother said a shocking thing one time, at least it shocked me at the moment. And she said, I have never lost my free will. Even being in full God consciousness, I could still choose not to be in God consciousness. Now that surprised me. I don't know why. It's just the way that we think about these things when we haven't had the experience. She says, only I choose always to have God consciousness. It is so obviously superior to her that nothing else competed. And if there is ever a choice of being in God consciousness or being in strictly human consciousness, it was no choice to her. Because God consciousness was so much more. Now sometimes we think, well, maybe I'll cease to exist. But look at Mother, look at Paramahansa Yogananda, Sri Yukteswarji, Lari Mahasaya, are these non-entities? Are these non-personalities? These are some of the greatest personalities that have ever lived. They were full of life, full of dynamism. So you see, it's not not living. It's just simply that veil of separation has been removed. So this is the great goal, if we are to take it in life, to go from the human to the divine, and then to realize the universal vision. Now, whether you call God, God, divine consciousness, Yahweh, Brahman, Nirvana, Mahanirvana, Brahman Nirvana, you see, these are all just various names for the same thing. Allah. They're all just same names, but it doesn't change the nature. Now, the fact that the name God has been misused down through time does not reflect on that pure spiritual being of which we are all a part. You see? And because lesser minds have taken control at times, doesn't besmirch that pure divine consciousness. Krishna says in the Gita that water cannot drown it, fire cannot burn it, it cannot be destroyed or stayed in any way. It is your eternal gift inside of you, and it doesn't make any difference what you have done in the past. We have all erred in life, in this life and past lives. There's no one who's taken on human incarnation and gone through this journey who have not. And so this is not a bar to realization. When you read the lives of saints, so many of them did not lead good lives beforehand. And yet, when they got ignited, their rockets jetted straight for realization, without any deviation to the left or the right. They knew what the alternative was. They knew how bad and dark life could become. So they weren't lukewarm about it. And I have seen that. I have seen souls who have led pretty tough lives. But when they got on the track, they went straight to the goal. Other people who have led good lives, they're kind of interested. They'll give a little bit of a shot. They'll meditate a little bit here and there, but they don't have the same fire. They don't have the same drive. So you see, none of that is of any consequence. It's of no consequence at all, other than we may have some things to face on our way to the goal because of things that we've done in the past. But we all do. We all have. So let us feel that light awakening inside of us. Let that faith begin to burn brightly inside of you. God is in control. Shift the burden onto Him. If some fear comes up in your mind, give it to God at the feet of God. Say, "This is yours. I am your instrument. You are the operator. You must see to it that this is all taken care of perfectly." And then not carry that burden one step further. You sensitively attune yourself to that divine consciousness. Now sometimes, especially in the beginning, we don't know if we're getting direction from God or if it's from our mind. And you can go according to the highest light that you know. But as you continue to meditate and as you continue to attune, you'll have experiences here and there at first. You'll be lifted up. You'll feel the purity. You'll feel the perfection. You'll feel the light of it. And it'll be a pure direction that comes to you. Now that may not happen all the time, but you'll get it here and there. And it'll teach you to look for the quality of that experience. That it goes beyond the mind. It goes beyond just preoccupations that you habitually think about. Or even just an inspiration that you have. Well, maybe it's this. It'll teach you to go deeper until you touch that purity. And when you do, you'll know the difference. You'll feel it, you'll experience it on every level. And that becomes your benchmark. Go to there until you feel absolutely inside of yourself, this is God's direction for me. In the meantime, you can go according to the highest light that you know, but never let go of the idea that you have that already inside of you. And to proceed on in faith that that perfection already dwells in you is one of the great things that God told me one time. That you don't have to make yourself perfect. You could never do it. Because you yourself, in an ego sense, are imperfect. But that perfection is already in you. And that is what makes you perfect. Jesus said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now, if you ask most people, they would think that's an impossibility. I can't be perfect. And from a human standpoint, that would be true. But perfection already dwells in you. It is sleeping, perhaps, but it is there. And when you touch it, you know it. Mother used to say, "I know, and I know that I know." You want that level, that depth of realization. So I'm so happy that we're all here and that we're focused on divine consciousness and the path and realization. There's no higher purpose for us to come together. And that you all feel inspired, that we all strive for the uttermost consciousness. Do not ever think that you can fully realize all of that which is God, because God is infinite. And consciousness will ever be expanding new frontiers. The change that comes is that you are ever one with God. You are never disconnected from Him. And this is our goal, and this is what we strive for with all of our faith, all of our strength, all of our mind, all of our soul. Let us chant some of Mother's song. You know, whenever there's a siren off in the distance, and whenever I hear a siren, I always think, I think of Mother Krishnabai. And what she said, she was with Papa Ram Dass, and she had asked Papa, because he had to translate it for her, to read the newspaper for her. And it would be later at night, 10 o'clock or so, and he would be reading that. And she would be nodding off to sleep, because she would get up at 3 a.m., and she worked hard all through the day, and then it was later at night. And he said, "Mataji, why don't you just go to sleep? You're having me read the news." "No, no, no, no. This is my opportunity to pray for every one of these situations, every one of these people." And so I think that's a wonderful thing to do when we read the news or hear about situations, fires down in California and these hurricanes and all the other things that are going on. But when I hear siren, I think, God bless those people that are in need, and God bless those that are going to give help. And see, you add your power of light, your power of grace, your power to whatever degree that we have it, toward helping to resolve a situation. And just think, if anybody's talking about a situation in their lives, instead of it depressing you or getting you down or getting excited about somebody else's misery, some people do, you actually start praying for those people in that situation, and how that deepens your awareness of the divinity within you. So let us sing, as Mother sang, this wonderful mantra, Om Shri Ram. Papa Ram Dass sang it continually, and it took him all the way to his perfect realization. So it's a powerful, powerful chant that's been chanted for many millennium in India. And it's Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. It means victory to God, victory to God. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Om. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Om. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Om. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om. Shri Ram Jai Ram. 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 Jai Jai Ram Om. Victory to God, victory to the light. Pranams, I bow to the great light within you. May it awaken in blazing glory to illuminate this world, to guide you all the way to your spiritual home, to awaken perfect faith in that pure light, now and always. Om Shri Ram, Shri Ram, Shri Ram.
Power of light and love.
Power of light and love. What was the last part?
I'm thinking of love.
Uh-huh.
Getting to know God's love.
Yeah.
And is that just part of light? Or?
It is. There are all the essential elements of divine consciousness are always present in it. So Mother used to say that when she stood on the earth with her 2 feet, she's connected to the entire earth. So in whatever way that you perceive God, feel him, receive him in any way, you're connecting with the entirety of all that that is. And you take that one point of connection, and then you let your mind dwell on that. Keep your mind there. You have a certain experience, a spiritual experience, and you think back on that, and suddenly you get a little... maybe not the fullness of that experience, but you get a little hint of it, a little feeling of it. That's your connection. That's your point of connection. Let that draw you. So love is part and parcel of divine consciousness. It is every bit as much as ananda, as bliss, as light, as the other elements that we talk about. When we love God, we feel that attraction. We want that state of realization. And it becomes consuming to us. We want it to be as strong as falling in love with another person. Because when you fall in love with somebody, you don't have to discipline yourself to think about them. You cannot not think about them. All through the day you're thinking, when will I see them next? What will they say? When can we talk? And so on. To have that kind of feeling towards God, that I want that more than anything else. So that is the love of God in our own heart, in a human sense. And then divine love awakens in our heart. Now, when this heart center opens, it can be painful. And we've suffered, in a human sense, we've suffered along the way when it comes to love. We've loved somebody, and then that love ends, or... something happens and we feel hurt by it in some way. And so we tend to guard our heart. But one time Mother looked at me and she said, unless you love God completely, you cannot have realization. And it got me thinking about all the ways that I guarded and protected my heart. I had to let go of all of that. Well, but what if it should be painful again? Could I stand that? And I thought, it ultimately, and it took me a few weeks to work through it, it doesn't make any difference if it destroys me. I can't make the progress if I don't love completely. So it started me on that journey, but it gradually came about, and I started reading two books. One was about St. Francis, a great lover of God, and the other was about Ramakrishna, another great lover of God, East and West. Two different personalities, both had tremendous consuming love for God. And at the time, I didn't feel like I had any love at all for anything. And that got me started and got me really opening myself to the possibility of having love like that. And when it finally awakened, it did so in a very big way. And then once you feel it, then you attune yourself to it, and you actually feel love flowing through your heart like a great river. And it's a tremendous experience, and you surrender yourself to it. And that takes you on further on this journey towards realization. So it has lots of elements, this human sense of how to love God, this divine love as it starts to flow through us, that God is love. I have oftentimes said is both a noun and a verb. It is a state of being, and it is also an activity that flows through the heart. We live in an ocean of love. But how many of us realize it? The air itself is scintillating with love. And when we realize that, that's divine love. And then it's not personal in the sense, oh, I love you because you do what I want you to do, or you do things that make me feel good, therefore I love you. And if you stop doing those things, I don't love you anymore. That's human love with an equation, with a ledger sheet up there. Huh? If you've made so many deposits, then maybe I'll deign to give you a little bit of something too. That's human love. But divine love is different. It flows spontaneously because that's its nature. It could do nothing else. So that's the love that we want. And that's God's love in you flowing out to the world. Not different from His light, not different from all the other qualities that are the absolute qualities of God.
So is there a particular visualization to use with that, with opening the heart?
Visualization can be helpful.
Taking those barriers.
Yeah, absolutely. And just what you're describing, just taking the barriers down, letting all of that go, doing everything in our power to let go of those things that keep us from loving fully. But ultimately, it's grace that enters in and unleashes that divine love. It's an experience. It's not something we can just imagine or even make it happen, other than doing everything in our power to letting go of those barriers and those obstacles to it flowing.
With the Gospel of Ramakrishna that you mentioned, is there a particular way that you recommend reading it, just cover to cover?
You can pick it up at any place.
It's such a big book.
Yes. You know, there's... It does tell his story from Master Mahasaya, you might remember from the autobiography of Yogi, and Master thought so much of him, and he was a worshipper of Divine Mother. And also there is a segment from the autobiography where Yogananda goes to Dakshineshwar, which is where Ramakrishna had been, and he went there to help reform his brother-in-law. and he had a tremendous experience there. So these are both connected with Ramakrishna, who had left the body before Master came into the world. But you can pick that book up at any point and start reading. It is sequential in that sense, but there's nothing about the story that's you'll be lost if you just pick it up and start reading any place. It's truly a marvelous, marvelous book. It's a book about a God-realized being written by a God-realized being. It's unique in this world. And Ramakrishna had no education, and yet he had pundits, he had intellectuals, people coming to him. He just spoke out of the fount of wisdom based on his own experience and how God expressed himself through him. And he was very unusual because he is absolutely universal. That for him, he had worship through Christ, through Shiva, through Kali, through all the different major religions, and each one had taken him into that state of realization, into samadhi. And so he was there to say, it doesn't make any difference which religion or no religion. The thing is to love God. Yeah. You'll be caught up in that spirit, so just pick it up wherever you like.
Well, that's kind of what I've been doing, is just opening it up.
Yeah.
And there were some markers in it from, I think from you, that Jill left in there, and so I've been opening up to some of those places.
Yeah. It truly is a gospel. Good news. See, when I say that this world is God and blissful, I feel it in this room here, from all of you, from the walls, ceiling, floor, it's all vibrating. There's nothing greater.
Room is happy because you're here. That's why it's singing.
Don't leave us ever.
I think it was singing before I got here.